Hello and welcome back to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. Well, students taking this course, perhaps this is the first course in toxicology and perhaps maybe the first of many courses in related areas of pharmacology and toxicology that you will take. But perhaps you get a realization that the natural world around us is broadly toxic. In that organisms, humans, the other organisms in nature, have to have developed a response to this broadly toxic environment in the natural world and also in the synthetic world that we have created. In today's lecture, what we're going to do, and I've kind of subtitled this perhaps on the website as the white hats and the black hats of cowboy lore fighting back amongst themselves. Today's lecture, Biotransformation and Elimination of Toxicants, is the first one where we've introduced how the organism has the chemical or biochemical ability to biotransform some of these chemical toxins and toxicants and aid in their elimination. This is a little bit high-end in terms of chemistry, biochemistry. Those of you that are weaker in these fields will be perhaps a little bit strained. There's enough discussion in the used textbook to kind of bring you along, and hopefully the lecture will kind of give you the requisite basis to understand at least the basic principles of biotransformation and elimination. Our learning objectives here today, what I'd like you to do is to be able to explain the role of this biotransformation in toxicokinetics. So how, in fact, does biotransformation actually aid in relieving us from the potential toxic end effects of these chemical compounds? You'll need to be able to describe how biotransformation facilitates elimination of toxicants. We've introduced this concept of grease to salt, that highly polar compounds that are water soluble are typically able to be eliminated more rapidly, primarily through the urine stream. We'll try to as well have you distinguish between phase one and phase two reactions. These are broad categories of reactions. We'll show you how these, in fact, are the key components in metabolism that aid in elimination. We'll try to define bioactivation, or another word for that is toxication. And this is a curious byproduct of the chemistry and biochemistry that happens in biotransformation, where in fact these pathways of metabolism sometimes activate a chemical compound to increase its toxicity. So a chemical that may in and of itself be mildly reactive typically or mildly toxic gets activated. It becomes very reactive, and sometimes this causes an increase in the toxicity of the compound due to its initial steps in this biotransformation process. We'll try as well to identify some of the tissues and factors involved in biotransformation. We'll have you summarize the role of elimination in toxicokinetics. If we talk about half-life, removals, plasma concentrations, all of these over time have to do with our ability to metabolize and set up for elimination these initial chemicals as toxicants. We're also going to want to have you describe the processes that occur in the kidney, the liver, and the lung that are related to the elimination of toxicants. This is a very basic sort of anatomy and physiology description, but in toxicology, these organs, and especially kidney and liver, are organs that perhaps it is best to have a more in-depth understanding relative to, for example, muscular movement in an anatomy and physiology class. Well, metabolism is a great place to start, and metabolism we can think of as the sum of the biochemical reactions that occur to a molecule within the body. Now, we have metabolism because we need to create energy, we need to sustain all the building blocks and the molecules of life for organismal development. We've defined previously that anabolism is the build-up, whereas catabolism is, in fact, the breakdown of products. And so we start off, for example, with monomers, and we build up polymers in an anabolic sort of process. the catabolic processes break those larger molecules down, chew them up enzymatically, chemically, biochemically, and sometimes this aids in their elimination, but it also can aid in, for example, the use of amino acids from proteins consumed in the diet. Where this occurs, it's primarily in the cytoplasm or at specific cellular organelles, and in fact, the storage of chemicals helps in the ability to biotransform, or at least affects the ability of the organism to biotransform and eliminate these toxic compounds. We've discussed perhaps more than you'd like to hear how toxicants can be sequestered in bone and in lipid for lipid-soluble contaminants. In fact, storage affects this because it sequesters them away from the metabolic pathways. And so, for example, individuals that go through dramatic, rapid weight loss, where they have a significant weight loss, loss of adipose tissue in a short amount of time, do have the potential to be releasing fairly high levels of adipose stored toxicants that would need then to be biotransformed by the liver and set up for elimination. And yes, there probably can be some low-level toxicosis associated or toxic stress associated with rapid weight loss, in the same way we've seen that episode in terms of a clinical case study of Graves' disease causing bone loss and the release of stored lead residues in bone in that particular case study. In terms of biotransformation, we can define this as the process that changes substances from hydrophobic to hydrophilic. And this is in order to aid in elimination. We've referred to this several times in the course of the principles of environmental toxicology as a transformation of grease to salt. Greasy hydrophobic molecules being transformed or biotransformed into salty or highly polar hydrophilic molecules, one that are water soluble to aid in elimination. Now, does this define all of the possible pathways of metabolism and biotransformation? No, but this is a major pathway of biotransformation. We need to do this because hydrophilic molecules are less able to cross various cellular membranes, and therefore they are less fluid filterable. And this is going to be a part of kidney physiology that we'll discuss here today. The major elimination routes that happen after biotransformation include fecal elimination, and this is through passing through assisted passage via the bile ducts and into the gastrointestinal tract for fecal elimination, and also through the kidneys for discharge in the urine stream. We have to be aware that in toxicokinetics, we're talking about the removal or decrease of the concentration of a toxicant once inside the organism. And there are several different characteristics of these processes, such as rate of decay and half-life. In the same way we looked at half-life in freshman chemistry chemical reactions, we can look at half-life in terms of removal half-lives of toxicants and look at those that are metabolized, for example, with very short half-lives, the time it takes to achieve one half of the original concentration. Those toxicants with very short half-lives are going to be ones that are metabolized and eliminated very rapidly, as opposed to longer half-lives, which indicate that the metabolism takes a significant amount of time. Now, in terms of broad categories of biotransformation reactions, we group these as phase one and phase two. Phase one is a functional group modification, and so what we're doing is reactive organic chemistry at a particular functional group of a small molecule toxicant. In phase two, what we do, and sometimes these follow one, then two, and we'll see this in a diagram here in a moment, In phase two, we have a conjugation reaction. Conjugation reaction is a reaction that takes two larger molecules and binds them together, or conjugates them. Typically, the molecule that we are binding to the toxicant is a very polar hydrophilic molecule, a sugar molecule, for example, or a sulfate moiety that we can attach to this as a side group to enhance the polarity, enhance the solubility of the toxicant. The goal of phase one, phase two biotransformation, again, is to produce these water-soluble metabolites to aid in their elimination. Now, this is not just biotransformation for detoxification or limiting the potential for toxicosis. This same process is actually available in normal physiology to activate natural and endogenous compounds in our diet for normal function. Okay, so these same sorts of biotransformation reactions allow the setup, the metabolic setup, whether it be anabolic or catabolic setup, of all of the starting materials that we need to develop energy, to develop nutrients, to develop various molecules of life in the organism. Now, we've introduced that some compounds, because biotransformation has to do with thermodynamics and kinetics. If you remember from freshman chemistry, thermodynamics tells us if a certain reaction can happen. Kinetics tells us how fast it will happen. Just because we have good thermodynamics doesn't mean that perhaps our bodies have geological time to undergo a reaction that in fact has extraordinarily slow kinetics. But some compounds will in fact, in this biotransformation pathway, undergo, because of thermodynamics and because of kinetics, a bioactivation reaction. And this chemistry is not necessarily smart, it's just looking at electrons and energy and thermodynamics and the nature of the beast, and the beast is chemistry. Sometimes it's blind to the quality of the product. Sometimes the quality of the metabolic product is sufficiently degraded with respect to its potential toxicity. Degraded meaning that it is toxicity enhanced. The term is bioactivation, so in our biology we have activated, a lowly or moderately toxic compound into a compound that is higher toxicity. Now, in terms of all of the myriad of results of biotransformation, they can increase toxicity, as we've just introduced, via a toxic metabolite. We would like that it decreases toxicity via the metabolism of the toxic parent compounds, and this is more typical when we are talking about biotransformation. As well, we can change or slightly modify a molecule, and especially a molecule that is has perhaps multiple active sites. We can modify that slightly through biotransformation, but have very limited or no effect on the overall toxicity of the parent chemical. We can also, through biotransformation, find that we are enabled to metabolize the endogenous compounds in our body that are produced by various enzymatic processes that are yielded to us via our diet and other sorts of exposures. And again, the metabolic products are often those starting products in terms of the survival of the organism. Now, this cartoon gives you at least a geographical representation of the major categories and reactions in biotransformation. You can see that in phase one, we can group the chemical reactions of oxidation or reduction or hydrolysis, these organic chemical reactions, these metabolic reactions, that in some cases are sufficient to increase the polarity in and of itself to aid in elimination. Some of these actually set up different functional groups for a secondary reaction or a phase two reaction where there is a conjugation synthesis, again conjugation being the joining of two molecules. These typically yield very polar metabolites. One of the things that you should gain a respect for is because we have different reactive pathways, even within phase one, oxidation, reduction, hydrolysis, and then in phase two as well, in terms of the potential to join on different functional groups or different conjugated molecules, that because of this variability, we can actually have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different metabolic products, okay, in various concentrations. And so there are often multiple pathways that we find in normal biotransformation metabolism. In terms of the enzymes of biotransformation, these are the tools that allow these reactions to happen. Enzymes don't get consumed. They assist in the reaction. In terms of phase one enzymes for oxidation, this is the most important pathway in toxicology. Oxidation adds an oxygen, it removes a hydrogen, or it increases valence. Some of the enzymes involved, the biochemical molecules, the biochemicals involved in phase one reactions include cytochrome P450, mixed function oxidases or MFOs, various specialty enzymes such as alcohol dehydrogenase, important after you have that next beer, various oxidases and others. Enzymes often carry the name ASE at the end of the name with the functionality of the enzyme at the beginning. So an oxidase is an enzyme that is involved in oxidation, just as a reductase is involved in reduction. Reduction is less important in biotransformation for toxicology. In reduction, we remove an oxygen or add a hydrogen, and we would decrease, therefore, the valence. We also have enzymatic biotransformation reactions that are have an endpoint of hydrolysis, and hydrolysis is simply involving the addition of a water molecule in a reactive sequence to a molecule. Various enzymes perform this function. They're referred to as esterases, phosphatases, and others. And so there are multiple levels of potential phase one reactions. Each one has an enzymatic reactive pathway. Some of these phase one reactions, and this is a table from the used textbook. You can see an N oxidation of an amine, an S oxidation, a carbonyl reduction to an alcohol, ester hydrolysis, desulfuration, dehydrogenation to a carbonyl. All of these are potential phase one metabolic pathways involved in biotransformation. In phase two, we have, again, enzymes that assist in the reaction, but we have a different player because we need that cofactor, that other molecule, as well as the enzyme to affect the conjugation that we call phase two. What happens in a phase two biotransformation is that we have an enzyme, typically a transferase enzyme, that transfers this conjugation molecule conjugate to the parent toxicant. The enzyme catalyzes it. The cofactor is a molecule that donates the conjugating group. These cofactors sometimes will include glucuronic acid, glutathione, sulfate, acetyl groups, methyl groups. The end product of a phase two biotransformation reaction is to increase the molecular size, and sometimes this is a substantial increase in overall molecular weight and size, and also to increase the polarity to add in its water solubility and therefore its potential to be excreted. Give you an idea of what phase two cofactors look like. This is glutathione. You can see that glutathione, in fact, is a fairly large molecule. It's a shuttle or a transport molecule because, in fact, glutathione in a phase two reaction is just donating this sulfhydryl group here. And so all of this apparatus, as you'll see quite often in these cofactors, are support to be able to position the chemical in the right reactive sequence in a pyrotransformation reaction. This is acetyl coenzyme A, another phase two cofactor. And again, this molecular apparatus of acetyl coenzyme A is a part of the transformation, but in fact, the change The biotransformation point is just this group down here, starting at the sulfur. And so this acetyl group is allowed to be added to the parent toxicant, again, to increase its polarity and its molecular size. This is PAPS, phosphoadenosine phosphosulfate, and again, a lot of molecular machinery over here that you can see. The idea is to donate this sulfate group here, so PAPS donates sulfate to a molecule, again, enhancing polarity and molecular size. Another cofactor, UDPGA, uridine-5-diphosphoglucuronic acid. It's donating a sugar here, down here, so we see a glucose type sugar. The molecular apparatus here on this side of the highlighted oxygen is the delivery mechanism within that cofactor. Give you an idea of how this works in the whole orchestra, the symphony of biotransformation for phase one and phase two. This is benzene metabolism. Benzene is a known carcinogen, and there's a reason why it's a carcinogen. And we didn't know that when I was a sophomore organic chemistry major, when we would wash our glassware and dishes in buckets of benzene, putting our hands in that benzene. What we've come to learn about benzene has concerned many in terms of its role of in various cancers and such as leukemia, and potential exposure of individuals that work in the petroleum hydrocarbon industries. So in benzene, the initial steps, we have an epoxidation. So this is a phase one reaction. The enzyme is cytochrome P450, and so we get this toxic epoxide. And so in the initial step of biotransformation of benzene, we have a toxication or a bioactivation. And in fact, it's this reactivity that many suggest is a part of the carcinogenic nature of benzene. And to give you an idea of the multiple pathways, since we have this reactive metabolite, it can actually combine to become a phenol, get acted on by UDP and glutathione transferase to become a glucuronide molecule. A fairly large sugar is added onto this, creating a highly polar molecule from an initial starting product, a toxicant that is nonpolar. With sulfur transferase and PAPS as a cofactor, we can see that we add a sulfate group on here, again enhancing polarity and molecular size. In this particular case, we can have an epoxide hydratase enzymatic reaction, creating a dihydrodiol, enhanced polarity, enhanced water solubility. In this particular direction, we have a glutathione transferase enzyme and glutathione acting to add glutathione on this particular molecule, again, also enhancing in the conjugate molecular size, molecular weight, and polarity, and therefore water solubility. This also gives you an idea of if an animal, test animal, is dosed with benzene, the array of potential metabolites, if we count them off, 1, 2, 3, 4 metabolites that can be identified primarily in the urine stream, sometimes in the breath, sometimes in the fecal matter. We sometimes do these analyses by doing radio-labeled chemical compounds like radio-labeled benzene. Radio-labeling acts to enhance detectability of metabolites. What we try and do in these metabolic studies is examine the animal's elimination tracts to identify the total toxic residue, the TTR. The total toxic residue hopefully is greater than 80% recovery of the initial radio-labeled elements in the test compound. And so this aids in identifying the metabolic products from any sort of other metabolic byproducts from normal, natural, non-biotransformation processes of the dosed toxicant. For aniline, it's oxidized as another alternative biotransformation example. It is oxidized by cytochrome P450, and so you get this N-hydroxylation. This again sets this up. This is a more reactive functional group. It sets it up for a phase two conjugation as an example. We can see dialkylation in this particular case. Dimethylpropylamine acted on by cytochrome P450, and so we're oxidizing this particular propylamine group, and it becomes a methyl propylamine. And with an acetaldehyde, this is a more reactive group, again set up for phase two conjugation on the pathway of phase one, phase two biotransformation. One of the byproducts of phase one oxidation and reduction can be the generation of free radicals. Free radicals are reactive. They can be reactive in terms of cell wall destruction. In our next lecture, what we will talk about is oxidative stress, the ability of free radicals generated, for example, by normal respiratory processes, to enable a chain reaction, reactive sequence that is extremely destructive to tissues and organs and organelles in the body. In this particular case, we have tetrachloromethane acted on by NADH, cytochrome P450, and reductase. One of the byproducts generated in this metabolic cycle is a toxic free radical. That free radical can react with our normal oxidative stress management system. One of the ways we do that is a reaction with glutathione. Give you a case study here of a biotransformation metabolic interruption. This case study deals with the appearance of fluorocitrate and its disruption of the Krebs cycle. As it turns out, fluorocitrate is a natural compound. It's typically available in alkaline soils. In Australia, there's a relationship of fluorocitrate, which is found in legume pasture plants, Gastrolobium and Oxylobium. Sometimes the concentrations in the leaf can be as high as 2.5 grams per kilogram. This is a very high concentration chemical. It's highly lethal. Its mammalian lethality is 1 milligram per 1,080 kilogram animal, is the way that worked out. And the reason I put it that way is this chemical compound, because of its high lethality, was often referred to as compound 1080. It was actively used as rodenticide and as a bait material, for example, for rats or gophers or ground squirrels. In the United States, it was banned in the late 80s because of non-target species effects. In fact, typically what would happen is predatory birds would see an animal that had been intoxicated by this fairly violent and highly lethal poison. The secondary toxicosis would occur when the predatory bird would actually feed from the dead or dying animal, and in fact there were observations of birds being impacted by this in mid-flight after they fly off from perhaps a carrion feeding event and pretty much drop out of the sky. Whether or not that's true or just anecdotal, we don't know, but I have heard that story from reliable sources. In Australia, what we find is an adaptation, since these plants contain this highly lethal substrate, which I'll show you will interrupt quite well the Krebs cycle for primary energy production. It appears that the rat and gray kangaroo of Western Australia have evolved resistance. This is where this plant has a dominant role in the local plant ecosystem. They do this resistance by a in vivo defluorination process with glutathione. Well, in terms of just animal management, it was a harsh discovery to find out in typical wildlife management activities of relocating animals from one area to another. In some areas of Australia, the kangaroo is a bit of a nuisance animal. They found that some of these animals that were relocated into Western Australia had not evolved this resistance, and in fact succumbed to the toxicosis of this very highly toxic and very violent poison. How this happens and how it's used in a particular rodenticide, we actually back it up not from fluorocitrate, We actually use the body's own chemistry to take fluoroacetate, which is the chemical compound that is used in 1080 and as a rodenticide. Coacetyl A creates a fluoroacetyl CoA in terms of biosynthesis. And so the initial steps of biotransformation actually creates this fluoroacetyl CoA. This fluoroacetyl CoA creates instead of citrate, a fluorocitrate molecule. This is the problem, in fact, this non-reactivity of this halogenated side chain here is what causes the disruption of the Krebs cycle. It causes the disruption of the Krebs cycle because as we go from a transformation from oxaloacetate into citrate, we instead form this fluorocitrate molecule when we have this fluoroacetyl CoA enzyme being formed, cofactor being formed. In fact, this then can't be acted on by aconitase to form cis-aconitate in the Krebs cycle. And again, the Krebs cycle, a critical part of mitochondrial energy production. Without energy, the cell dies because of transport problems in terms of cellular processes. This starts a cellular death and leads to a very rapid and, in many cases, very violent death of the organism. Another toxin, this is a natural toxin, deoxynivalenol. It also has a common name of vomitoxin. Vomitoxin probably came from the purgative aspects that this particular mold toxin has in terms of animals that eat it. It's a fusarium trichothecene. This is a mycotoxin or a toxin from mold that is found on corn and barley, for example. There are typically several large-scale fusarium outbreaks globally, sometimes with lethality. This is a part of agriculture, a part of grain production. Typically, moldy grain happens when environmental conditions for mold growth, which are typically can be, depending upon the mold, typically moist, and it can range from cool to hot conditions depending upon the mold. What we find is in the developed world is that there are a significant amount of oversight in terms of preventing mold growth on grains. But sometimes in rural communities or in underdeveloped countries, moldy food is better than no food, and sometimes we have the onset of human toxicosis from these mycotoxins. This particular mycotoxin has a reactive epoxide ring. In terms of the early stages of biotransformation, because we have a reactive group, we actually form this carbon compound and reduce this particular chemical because it is so reactive. Another mycotoxin is aflatoxin B1. Aflatoxin B1 comes to us from the Aspergillus mycotoxin. It's found on corn, peanuts, and cottonseed. Aspergillus and aflatoxin are easy to identify because aflatoxin fluoresces, and so there are screening methods. Your peanut butter is actually, the commercially bought peanut butter is screened for aflatoxin residues because aflatoxin is a carcinogen. It's a naturally occurring carcinogen. It has a potential to form a DNA adduct, and scientists think that this is the mode of carcinogenesis for this particular chemical compound. It does have the potential for acute toxicity as well. When we do some analyses, and we've talked about metabolism and how we study metabolism, in that sometimes we will take a chemical compound and do an in vitro analysis of its metabolic pathways. And the way we do this is usually with isolated rat hepatocytes. And so, for example, this data, and I'm not sure exactly where this came from, but this might have come from an in vitro or a petri dish test tube type study, where this chemical compound, aflatoxin B1, was actually put into a petri dish with isolated rat hepatocytes and cultured, and then the scientists would look via mass spectrometry typically for the various aflatoxin metabolites. This one is Q1. There's a whole range of potential metabolites in aflatoxin. I think they number about 15 or 20 total. But here you can see that the results of biotransformation in this particular experiment puts a hydroxyl group on here, again enhancing the polarity, enhancing the ability for elimination of this compound. Benzopyrene is the chemical of concern when you hear warnings about consuming too much barbecued meat. Barbecue that we all love in the summertime and in our tailgate parties. Benzopyrene is a polyaromatic hydrocarbon, often referred to as PAHs, typically highly nonpolar assembly of benzene rings here. It is an environmental carcinogen. It comes to us not only through barbecued food, but also through combustion of fuels, petroleum hydrocarbons, diesel fuels, coal fuels. Typically, again, we study these things with cell cultures from rodents, fish, and humans. What we find is that the pathway is not particularly species specific, that we find these benzopyrenes developed with in terms of phase one, phase two biotransformation. They are conjugated with a sulfate or glucuronic acid. This molecule on the left, the benzopyrene, being a very nonpolar molecule with a glucuronic acid attached to it, highly polar and more water soluble. Let's transfer a little bit here. We've talked a lot about biotransformation related to organic molecules. Let's use a few slides to go back and talk about a recurring theme that we'll use as a case study and example in Principles of Environmental Toxicology, and that being heavy metal toxicity associated with lead. With lead, we find that, as we have discussed before, that it's absorbed via active transport calcium channels as a divalent ion. In terms of lead and lead exposure, remember that lead can be presented to us in our environment and in our diet in many different forms, as lead metal, lead oxides, lead salts. Typically, in terms of a toxicology concern, we are most concerned with highly soluble lead salts. These divalent ions are capable of reacting with a wide variety of binding sites because of the density of lead. We have the potential for protein precipitation. When a protein, for example, in your plasma is precipitated, it no longer can do what it needs to do, whether that be a transport or enzymatic or hormonal function. So the specific toxic effect depends upon reactions with the various ligands. Ligands will bind, so we have anionic ligands that will bind with the cationic lead. Sometimes those ligands are essential in terms of fundamental processes for the living system. Some of these ligands form with sulfidyl groups, so we actually have some proteins, metallothionein, for example, with sulfidyl groups that aid in the elimination of heavy metals. But sometimes these groups are associated with proteins or enzymes that are destined or tracked to another important physiological processes, and this, in fact, would interrupt or disrupt those processes and lead to potential toxicosis. The other reactive pathways that lead can take is reaction with amino groups, phosphate groups. Lead phosphate or pyrophosphate is a highly, highly thermodynamically stable chemical. If we have reactive phosphate groups on molecules, we can interrupt that with lead reaction in adsorption or co-precipitation. Imidazole and hydroxyl groups are also reactive groups of various enzymes and essential proteins that may interact with lead. We find that the sensitivity of a particular system and its degree of interference will determine some of the clinical effects. We find that in lead exposure that digestion and respiration and especially the action or activity of, for example, stomach acids can lead to absorption. In terms of heavy metal toxicity, the liver is the primary organ for detoxification, and that's typically by chelating and shuttling it away. We find that the kidney does have the potential to excrete subclinical levels of heavy metals. As I've said many times, our natural environment is rife with potential toxicants. The soils in many communities are 1, 2, 3, 4 part per million natural background, just because of the natural makeup of the soil. It is not a toxic waste dump, it's just that these natural elements are out there. We worry about them when in industrial processes like mining or leaded gasoline or leaded paint in old houses tend to concentrate this particular heavy metal in a environment, an intimate environment that we are exposed to on a daily basis in our living environment or in our jobs in terms of an occupational exposure. Now, in terms of minimizing the effects of heavy metal toxicity such as lead, the antidotes that we use are typically competing ligands. I've put the molecular form of EDTA, ethylene diamine tetracetic acid, on here. You remember from your freshman chemistry laboratories when you did metal complexation, metal binding with copper, perhaps lead, and many others with EDTA, and you formed a precipitant, sometimes colored, sometimes white, in the bottom of the test tube. The idea here is to bind up and therefore decrease the reactivity. This is referred to as chelation therapy when it is used in a clinical setting. We find that metallic lead is absorbed most efficiently by the respiratory tract, and so we've introduced here in the course of our discussions of IEUBK and the blood lead model that in fact household dust is a primary vector, and perhaps the primary vector in terms of childhood lead exposure. We find that about 10% of ingested lead is absorbed. We have a term for that. Typically, it's called bioavailability. Each chemical in each particular manifestation of that chemical, again, like lead metal, lead oxide, lead salts, will have a distinct bioavailability. It has a lot to do with its ability to pass through various transport barriers, various membranes to hijack a facilitated absorption process. All of these vary on a case-by-case basis with the particular heavy metal or the particular toxicant. As we find out, in terms of lead ingestion, the small intestine is where a lot of this happens. Lead salts are soluble in gastric juices, and so they are absorbed fairly directly. It goes from the plasma to the blood cells, has an endpoint in the erythrocytes in terms of its ability to bind with various proteins in the erythrocytes. After oral ingestion, and this is a chronic exposure, we find that about 60% ends up in the bone. We also find it in the hair and teeth. About 25% ends up in the liver hepatocytes, about 4% in the renal tubules of the kidney, and we'll talk about that physiological formation here momentarily. And about 3% resides in the intestinal wall. And so there is a distribution of exposed lead, a systemic distribution throughout. But again, the primary storage sites after oral ingestion are in the bones and teeth. It's interesting that in terms of retrospective epidemiological monitoring of childhood lead exposure, that baby teeth have become very valuable. We lose our baby teeth nominally around 6 years old. These are a good record of our exposure in early childhood, and there actually have been studies that have cataloged early childhood lead exposure via baby teeth monitoring and the outcome of the individual in terms of their behavioral dispositions, their success in life, and indicators such as IQ and learning ability. Unfortunately, we find that children exposed to lead in early childhood actually are lower on the scale in terms of all of the behavioral and intelligence performance indicators that we find in life follow-ups after they're, for example, 20 years old. In terms of heavy metal toxicity for lead, some of the endpoints, again, are sulfidal enzyme inhibition, because the reactivity of lead salts with sulfidal groups is significant. The KSP, or solubility product of heavy metals and sulfide type groups, is usually on the order of 10 to the minus 20, 10 to the minus 30, meaning that these precipitate out, or these react with a high degree of Gibbs free energy, or delta G reactivity, to produce very thermodynamically stable end products. We find that potassium transport is inhibited in red blood cells. This will lead to anemia. There can be examples of porphyrinuria, or porphyrin-type compounds, or hemoglobin molecules in the urine. We find that lead is excreted chiefly in the feces and the urine. And in terms of clinical therapeutic treatment, we use chelating agents such as calcium EDTA. We can use penicillamine. It's not only an antibiotic, but it's a very good, its mode of action actually in its in antibiotic therapy is the fact that it's a calcium binding chemical. If you recall the last time you took a beta-lactam drug like a penicillin, on the label they typically advise you not to take this with dairy products. Another chelating reagent is BAL, or dimercaptrol. BAL stands for British anti-Lewisite. This was actually used in World War II as an antidote to some of the heavy metal chemical warfare agents that were used in World War I. The chemical compound dimercaptopropanol, or BAL, I've shown you up here in terms of what it looks like, but you can see these sulfhydryl groups here that are reactive chelating agents in terms of clinical therapies for heavy metal toxicity. Next few slides, I'm just going to recount here for you a quick little case study, one of the hazards perhaps of drinking moonshine or home-distilled alcohol, high concentration alcohol. This was a report from CDC's Mortality Morbidity Weekly Report in 1992. The case study has to do with individuals that were brewing moonshine in some rural Alabama counties in 1991. Eight persons were presented to the hospital. They were diagnosed with elevated blood levels. Nine patients had been also elevated, showing elevated related medical conditions at the hospital related to alcohol and alcoholism. Some of the manifestations included tonic-clonic seizures, microcytic anemia, encephalopathy, which is a degradation of brain tissue, extreme extremity weakness in the upper extremities, and abdominal colic. The blood lead levels in these individuals ranged from 16 micrograms per deciliter to 259 micrograms per deciliter. The median of this particular group was 67 micrograms per deciliter, well over toxic indicators. Typically, an action level for blood lead in children is 10 micrograms per deciliter, and we worry about acute toxicosis with values in excess of 40 micrograms per deciliter. Well, as it turns out, they were using used automobile radiators as condensers in their stills. These stills then, because of the heat and because of the potential acidity of what they were distilling, actually leached significant amounts of lead out of the soldering in the particular radiators they were using in their moonshine operations. 7 patients required hospitalization for 48 hours or longer, some as long as 18 days. 3 of the patients received chelation therapy. The initial blood lead levels in those individuals were 67, 228, and 259 micrograms per deciliter. These are very high numbers all. One of the patients, actually the one who had the lowest level, actually did die and succumb to this particular toxicity. And there was an alcohol withdrawal symptomology and some aspiration pneumonia associated with that in terms of complications. The individuals involved in this reported moonshine ingestion ranging from about 2/10 of a liter to 1.5 liters per day, significant alcohol consumption all. The lead contents of the specimens of moonshine that were confiscated nearby actually contained about 7,000 parts per million, or 7,000 parts per billion to 9,000, 10,000 parts per billion, so about 7 to 10 parts per million or milligrams per liter. And the in terms of looking from an epidemiological perspective about other sources of lead, there was a very limited lead exposure through normal drinking water in the county. What they did in terms of a retrospective epidemiological analysis, trying to do dose reconstruction, they found that consumption of about 0.5 liter a day of this moonshine containing the higher level, approximately 10 parts per million, would result in a steady state blood lead level of about 190 micrograms per deciliter. Significant exposure, significant toxicity, a very unfortunate event in terms of lead toxicosis in a small cluster. Well, our next step, we've talked about biotransformation. Our next step is, because all of this was a setup for elimination, is to look at the primary routes of elimination of toxicants. These include urinary elimination, fecal elimination, and respiratory elimination. We have some other potential routes of elimination, obviously, in our saliva. We can sweat out toxicants. Some of you who have eat very spicy food, you may not smell it, but others will smell your sweat and sometimes smell some of the residue of the very pungent odors involved in the spices that you eat that come out in your sweat. We can have elimination of toxicants through milk and mammary gland transfer. We do have a barrier there, but we also have the potential to cross that barrier, especially for more water-soluble toxicants. Any sort of tissue that we have that is continuously growing, such as nails, hair, or skin, have the potential to sequester in some level toxicants, and because we shed those tissues, we have the ability to eliminate some element of the potential toxicant. Hair has been used as a time-based record of intoxication for stable inorganic toxicants such as lead or mercury. It's not particularly accurate, but it has been used in analysis, especially retrospective analysis, of long-term or chronic exposure to some example heavy metals. We can also find some in the cerebral spinal fluid in terms of the pathway of elimination. Not that we eliminate CSF directly, but it will then join as terms of the part of the fluid pathway finally being eliminated through the kidneys. The kidneys are probably the most important organ when we're talking about elimination, and so we'll spend a few slides here talking about kidney physiology on a macro basis and also on a cellular or an organelle basis in terms of how kidneys actually work to filter our blood. As it turns out, a kidney will produce about 45 gallons of filtrate per day in an adult human. So this is a pretty active organ. It's got very high blood flow. We'll talk about blood flow to relative organs next time. But we have in this particular organ parenchymal cells, all of the stuff inside essentially this water balloon, this active water balloon organ. And the reason we have an outside tissue, inside this containing tissue we have a primary set of active substructures in what's referred to as the renal cortex. This is where most of the filtration happens. The renal cortex is made up of subunits referred to as nephrons. These nephrons are individual filtering assemblies. They drain from the outside in. You can see that we are highly vascularized in the outer part of the cortex. As we descend down towards the center part of the kidney, we have what is referred to as the renal medulla. The fluid exchange happens primarily in the from the blood to the nephrons in the exterior parts of the kidney. We have the filtrate that then is transported through the renal medulla. There is some exchange reactions, membrane that go on in the renal medulla. Finally, there is some draining into the various papillas and the calyx, draining out into the ureter for storage in the bladder before the next time you urinate. Well, we can look at that, and this is again a kitchen top sort of dissection that you all can do with some tissues you get from the grocery store. This, in fact, is a bovine kidney, and again, from our cartoon, the renal cortex on the outside. This is highly vascularized out here, and so this is where the blood is exchanged and the primary filtration. The renal medulla takes the filtrate. There is some reabsorption that happens, but primarily it shuttles the processed filtrate and collects it, and we collect it down into the ureter. And so it's an outside infiltration. We have two kidneys. We have a little bit of backup in terms of our process. We do quite well in terms of asking our kidneys to process twice as much. These are very talented organs. They have some other aspects in terms of glandular function and our adrenal glands that exist in the kidneys in terms of hormonal development. These are incredibly talented organisms, but because they are filtering out, in some cases, toxicants and sometimes bioactive products of intoxication, whether it be metabolites or primary toxicants, there is the potential for tissue damage. We'll talk about that tissue damage next lecture when we talk about target organ toxicity. This cartoon helps us take a look at the actual actions and activity of an individual nephron. This is the renal filtration microstructure. It's fairly complicated, but if you break it down into its substructure, you find that it is wonderfully glorious in its filtration capacity. It filters not only on a size basis, like the coffee ground paper filter that you use to drink your morning coffee, but we also have membrane filtration, and we have membrane reabsorption happening. And this helps us filter out or remove materials, but also establish a hydrostatic or an osmotic balance between very important nutrients, glucose, for example, potassium, for example. It allows us to clean the fluids, but retain those nutrients that we need that are available in our bloodstream. Again, what you find is that we have a fairly highly vascularized unit here in terms of blood flow. The blood comes into a primary area referred to as the glomerulus, which is encased in what's referred to as the Bowman's capsule. And this is relationship of the small capillaries in there turning into the Bowman's capsule, which in fact has in the glomerulus actual physical pores. These pores are on the order of 40 angstroms. 40 angstroms is a pretty good size pore, but it's not overly large, and so what you actually have there is the ability to retain in the blood larger molecules such as protein. You probably all know that finding protein in your urine is not a good thing, and so what that typically means is that these pores have been damaged. They're larger than 40 angstroms and allowing for larger molecules to actually escape into the filtrate. So the first stage is actually like your coffee ground filter, allows the particles, the larger molecules, to be retained in the blood, but it allows small particles and solubles to actually enter the Bowman's capsule here and allow to start down the pathway of what is referred to as the proximal convoluted tubule. What you can see here is that we have a pathway, and so we've got the filtrate that now exits from the glomerulus in here, this membrane, this perforated membrane. And now on one side we have hydrostatic pressure, right? So we've got blood pressure on one side of the membrane, and so we do have the ability to push things through the pores and through the membrane into the capsule. The capsule will drain into the proximal convoluted tubule. Convoluted, lots of surface area, lots of twists and turns here in terms of a long pathway, a fairly reasonable retention time as your urine filtrate, your high concentration urine filtrate. And so at this point in time, we've actually not done much other than a physical filtration, pore-based filtration with a little bit of membrane action in the glomerulus. But what happens is in the proximal tubule, there is the opportunity for membrane reabsorption and transport, and we'll talk about the directions and the important molecules there as it continues its pathway down. We do have some vascularized sections, for example, the loop of Henle here. And then we finally get to the distal convoluted tubule, and we do get some reabsorption effects back here, some water balance in terms of membrane transport from one side of this back into the capillaries. And finally, we have drainage as we start progressing down the renal cortex, down to the renal medulla, and finally into the drainage of the kidney into the bladder. This particular histograph actually shows you a little bit of what a two-dimensional representation of the glomerulus in a nephron looks like. Remember, this is a two-dimensional view, and in this particular representation, we're actually looking down. For example, in these tubules, as you can see, these are actually looking at a cross-section of the cucumber. If we're looking at these long tubes, we're looking at it crosswise. And so you can see these tubules, you can see the glomerulus, this is lots of different convoluted pathways here. You can't, in this particular magnification, see 40 angstroms in terms of the perforations in here, but you can see in terms of the Bowman's capsule, the fact that there can be filtrate that collects in here that starts into the process direction through the proximal tubules and finally to the distal tubules prior to elimination. In terms of the processes of urinary excretion, there are three fundamental processes that happen in a nephron. They include glomerular filtration, it is followed by tubular secretion, and then followed by tubular reabsorption. This cartoon simplifies what a nephron does, and it gives us the three colors of where these different processes happen. Orange is glomerular filtration, kind of a reddish orange. A lighter orange is tubular reabsorption, and this green-yellow is tubular secretion. So if we see here in the glomerulus that we have active blood flow, that is coming into the glomerulus. There is a filtration that happens. In this filtration, we have small molecules, glucose, amino acids, minerals, and water that actually get filtered out. This is the 45 gallons per day of filtrate that gets processed. It enters the proximal tubule. And in the proximal tubule, we then get a membrane rebalancing. In this membrane rebalancing, about 99% of that water is reabsorbed. So on a daily basis, we only have about 1% of the fluid that's processed through the kidneys actually being eliminated through your urine stream. What we find in this secretion process, this filtrate is resecreted back across the membrane, back into the capillaries that surround that. And so what happens is water, it transports across that membrane, glucose, amino acids, some of those small proteins and minerals that have gone through the glomerular filtration. Further on down in terms of the distal part of the nephron, we find that we have a tubular reabsorption process. So we went from tubular secretion in this orange range down here into the yellow-green into the tubular reabsorption. What happens here is there's a balancing. Nearly all the water has been transported out. There's some balancing and reabsorption of additional ammonia and various creatinine and various metabolic byproducts that occur in terms of membrane transport into the distal tubule. We find that secretion in the upper parts, in the proximal tubule, is primarily polarity-based. We find that it's an active transport mechanism. There are separate systems for acid and base transport. Down here in the distal tubule, we find that this is more of a passive membrane osmotic pressure sort of transport system. We find that the water, the glucose, the amino acids are all balanced throughout the tubules in terms of prior to the collection in the efferent parts of the nephron. When we have a disruption of the kidney filtration, we typically will find this early on in clinical presentation of loss of water balance, water retention, if you will. Because of the damaged membrane, we don't exactly get that water balance that we need to sustain life. Kidney failure can be severely damaging to other organs in terms of water imbalance and the accumulation of metabolic byproducts in the blood plasma. The next route of elimination that we'll talk about, but we'll only talk about it briefly because it's a fairly simple, is that of fecal excretion. The active transport of toxicant metabolic products or primary toxicants is through excretion in bile directly into the intestine. And so we have active transport of a toxicant, parent and or metabolites with the emulsified bile acids and the fat that come to us. We've talked about the fact, and we'll talk about liver physiology a little bit more next time and target organ toxicity. But in the liver, we actually have a collection of bile acids in the gallbladder that allows for aid in digestion of fats. But we have active secretion of bile acids and these metabolic products in our bile duct. That bile duct is just south of the duodenum in the intestinal tract. We've talked about enterohepatic recirculation because of the fact that we have this digestive system here in the small intestine. We have a high degree of blood flow. The portal vein actually transports a high amount of this blood flow for the presentation of nutrients to the liver. And because we've got the potential here of this north and then south recirculation, that toxicants that are presented that come down through the dietary tract, the gastrointestinal tract, actually can be processed here. The parent compound or the metabolic product can be reabsorbed and cycled through. Again, the cartoon on the website, the animation that shows you enterohepatic recirculation. What we find in terms of the types of molecules Sometimes these are highly soluble phase two metabolites, large and ionized, that are present in the bile duct. We find it directly can be processed by excretion into the lumen of the GI tract just through blood transport mechanisms across the membrane. This will be a direct diffusion process from the bloodstream into the gastrointestinal tract. Finally, in terms of elimination, we've talked about and briefed you that our lungs, these extremely high surface area, I have a number here of 100 to 140 square meters of surface area in a typical adult lung. It's a very, very high surface area membrane. If you have a concentration of a volatile substrate on one side of that membrane, whether it's a toxicant in an inhaled breath or a toxicant or metabolite that has been bioprocessed on the other side of the membrane in terms of within the organism, we have the ability to have passive diffusion across that membrane and potential for respiratory exhalation, respiratory elimination of volatile toxicants. That's the final active elimination mechanism that we're going to talk about today. So what you have now is, I guess, the next steps in the whole sources, pathways, receptors, and controls discussion that we have here in Principles of Environmental Toxicology. The biotransformation and elimination of toxicants, again, comes to us because of the naturally occurring toxicants that occur to us in our normal daily exposures, environmental exposures, natural product exposures in terms of secondary plant chemical compounds that we might be exposed to in our diet, synthetic chemicals that we might be exposed to in our homes, our workplace, or in the natural environment as well. But we have a pretty good set of processes to detoxify this somewhat toxic world around us. Next time, what we're going to do is talk about target organ toxicology and how certain toxicants have the ability to affect direct toxicosis on specific organs, specific receptors within organs. Until that time, we'll see you again. Good luck to you.